Welcome to CICK News, the only news source in the North truly dedicated to local stories on the ground. CICK News addresses the diverse needs of the underserved communities between Burns Lake and Haida Gwaii through firsthand stories and in-depth interviews. CICK News funding is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially support campus and community radio stations in Canada, as well as the Government of Canada. We are your hosts, Pam Hassan and Dan Messick, and we are on the dial at 93.9 FM, Smithers Community Radio. Our call letters are CICK, and we are broadcasting from the unceded Gitindam territory, home of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Smithers Community Radio.
Today on CICK News, new research is giving us a glimpse of what is in store for Western Canadian glaciers in the coming decades. A new study just published in the journal Science under the title Global Glacial Change in the 21st Century, Every Increase in Temperature Matters, concludes that the planet will witness the disappearance of most of the world's glaciers within the next 80 years, especially within Western Canada. Based on current trends and the increases in emissions, the majority of Earth's remaining glacial ice will exist only in southeastern Alaska, the Northern Coast Mountains, the Yukon, northeastern Canadian and Russian Arctic, and mountains that are on the fringe of Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets. Now that Earth is set to see an average increase in temperature above 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold that scientists have been warning about for years to ward off runaway climate catastrophe, the melting of major glaciers around the world will contribute to an almost 5-inch increase in sea level rise over the next 80 years, which will see millions of people around the world forced from their homes along low-lying areas in coastal regions. This massive melt will also have drastic consequences for watersheds here at home, and especially aquatic habitat and local hydrological formations. We checked in with one of the co-authors of this paper, Dr. Brian Menounes, a professor at the University of Northern British Columbia, as well as a Hawkeye Institute affiliate and the Canadian Research Chair in Glacial Change. Stay with us.
My name is Brian Menounes. I'm a Canada Research Chair in Glacier Change, a Hawkeye affiliate, and a professor at the University of Northern British Columbia.
Great, Brian. Thanks so much for being with us today. Of course, as I mentioned to you just before we got going here, this latest research is built on some other studies that you've done in the same realm of glacier melt here in Western Canada, here in British Columbia especially. Maybe take me through a little bit of what this latest study has found and some of the concerns that are now being confirmed, and also, you know, some of the drastic changes that we're going to see in the next 80 years in terms of our melting glaciers.
Yes. So this particular study is a global one. Canada is one part. So Western Canada, the glaciers that are contained within Western Canada represent one region within this global study. And this particular study considers how glaciers are expected to change both in their area and volume by the end of this century. And the way that's done is one uses physically based models of how glaciers can adjust their dimensions to changes in either temperature or snowfall, and how they accommodate the melt or the gain of mass. And not surprising to perhaps most listeners is those glaciers are expected to not do well, specifically towards those high emission scenarios. So this study uses observational data that was collected in an earlier set of studies using space-borne observations of gone retreat and thinning. And those data are used to help calibrate and assess how reliable these projections are for the last couple of decades. And then using that information, one then projects under the different emission scenarios, or in our case for this paper, we decided to consider temperature change scenarios by the end of this century.
Dr. Menounes, maybe you can take me through what were some of the conclusions out of this. The information that I got basically showed that all these glaciers will be gone in the next 80 years. And one of the most poignant reminders was that if a child is born today or in the last couple of years, they might actually be the first generation to witness this kind of collapse of our glaciers. And what kind of impact is that going to have on the rest of these watersheds here in the Northwest, especially that are supported by these glaciers?
First, I'll just let people know if they don't already know, you know, why do we care about these frozen reservoirs of water? If you're not, for example, a tourist, and you're not interested in ice-clad mountains for their visual beauty or to access them, perhaps, you know, you are an aquatic species such as salmon or other aquatic ecosystem species, you're really concerned about when cool, plentiful water reaches creeks that perhaps you live in. And so that's the real special nature of these frozen ice reservoirs, is they release cool, plentiful water when the seasonal snow has been melted away. And we can think of that as an important buffering capacity, both in terms of water volume, but also the temperature of the water once it reaches those creeks. And so that buffering capacity becomes especially important during years of drought or during late summer if we get a hot spell. So you take away that buffering capacity and you set yourself up for some increased risks. In terms of Western Canada, even unfortunately under the best case scenario, that is if we limit warming by the end of this century to no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial time, we're expected to lose over 100,000 glaciers. And most of these glaciers are small, so they're less than or equal to 1 square kilometer. But again, we have to really understand that the disappearance of these glaciers really is going to affect that buffering capacity, and in some cases may elevate hazards posed by landslides in these watersheds. Just thinking about, for example, where in our province are glaciers located? They're really located at the highest elevations. If you go to the Rockies or the Columbia Mountains, for example, in the southern part of the province, we're usually considering ice that is, many of these smaller glaciers, the percent ice cover isn't as large as when we get into the northern coast and the St. Elias Range. But bringing it back, listeners around Smithers, for example, our projections show that, for example, Hudson Bay Glacier is likely to disappear, sadly, around the late 2050s to early 2060s. When we look at some of the watersheds that drain to the coast, such as the Skeena River Basin, this is a lightly glacierized watershed. It's almost 1% glacier covered by area. Despite the different temperature scenarios, we were expecting, unfortunately, complete deglaciation by the end of this century.
On that note, one of the, I guess, components of this study was that this isn't just focused on one particular area. As you mentioned, this is across the globe. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the collaborations, perhaps, that you have in other regions, other countries around the world that are trying to look at this to understand it better and perhaps, in some cases, to try to limit some of these changes and also, you know, adaptation. Obviously, if we lose glaciers in certain places that do provide water to watersheds after the glacial melt, we're not going to see that. We're going to see drought in particular places. So what kind of collaborations are going on to call attention to this situation and try to find a solution, at least in some part?
So this particular research contribution is really a joint effort by many different institutions, those that are European, North American, for example. So there's a lot of people that a lot of scientists that are working together on trying to understand not just how these glaciers may change in the future, but what can humans do to perhaps ensure that we will not lose all of our ice. So one of the take-home messages from this particular study is that when you look at it globally, every degree of temperature change that we agree on limiting does actually help to ensure that we will see some of these larger glaciers around at the end of this century. When we collectively look at it, whether they're small glaciers or large glaciers, when you put all of the melt, the projected melt from these glaciers, even under the sort of the good news scenario, that is we limit warming to 1.5 degrees, we're still looking at something on the order of 90 millimeters of sea level rise from the melting ice. That doesn't sound like a lot, but when you add that with the amount of sea level rise that's caused dirt by, for example, thermal expansion. So as we heat up the oceans themselves, they will expand in volume and cause sea level rise. In addition to that thermal expansion and melting from melting glaciers, we also have to worry about the great ice sheets. And so you put all these things together and you are... One is actually looking at a situation where many, many tens of millions of people are within harm's way. And specifically, this is, within 1 meter of projected sea level rise. There's a lot of people that live on the planet within 1 meter of current sea level. And so we are looking at wholesale relocation of many people on the planet for these changes.
You know, as I mentioned early on, we just had another COP conference to bring attention to many of the issues. Most of all, of course, the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius before pre-industrial era that we are going to break. That's definitely locked in, and it seems like the actions that, or the lack of action that comes from these COPs, we get reminded of that every year. And I wonder, where does this kind of land in that realm? How do we use this as a way to illustrate that climate change is now happening? We're seeing extremes, of course, of weather events. But this is one of the most visual aspects of melting glaciers, as you mentioned, the Hudson Bay Glacier here, one of the most well known in the region. You can see it right from the highway, and it's only in a matter of a couple of decades that it's really deteriorated to what is left now, and clearly that'll be one of the first to go. So where does this conversation kind of land amongst the COP 27, 28 and beyond conversations about this business, and how do we approach it?
That's a great question. I want to get back to Hudson Bay Glacier, because many years ago, when I first saw British Columbia on my way to working in Alaska as a university student, at that time, I hate to say it, but I did hitchhike through the province as an undergrad. I don't know if I would recommend doing that these days. But it was a great way to see the province, and I will never forget the view that I saw of Hudson Bay Glacier. Incredibly beautiful. The thought at that time of my life that we would be witnessing the eventual disappearance of that beautiful ice mass. So back to COP, and COP is an acronym for the Conference of Parties. So that is where the international organizations, the actual countries, will get together and agree to either disagree, unfortunately, such as what happened recently, or perhaps come together and make firm commitments about reducing greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel use. We can't forget that COP represents almost the pinnacle of action. And so the action really starts at the individuals, each individual within a given country, both in their actions, but also in their voting and looking for either municipal, provincial, or federal government to lead them to a sort of a decarbonized environment. And that's really where the individual has a lot of power. If you really view and appreciate Hudson Bay Glacier, or you appreciate many of our beautiful glaciers in the province, you have to let the government know what's acceptable and what's not. It's not an individual country, but we can't put our heads in the sand and say that we don't make the most emissions, therefore we don't have to worry about that. That is not good diplomacy. It is an issue that we all need to come together and work on. And we can't wait until 2050 to work on it. We have to work on it now.
I guess the last thing for you, Dr. Menounos, is just where do we go from here? Obviously, this is a growing body of work that you've been a part of. But what comes next? Where does this research go from here?
So one of the things that this particular study considered is using the best physically based models that we have right now to individually model and simulate how each glacier might respond to changes in precipitation and temperature. One thing these models don't have is how the surface of these glaciers, the snow and ice surfaces, are in many ways becoming darker through time. And so that darkening might be due, for example, to the introduction of dust or soot from forest fires. It may also be due to darkening of debris that accumulates year after year because we have more melt than retained snow. And so one of the things that the community is actively looking at is trying to simulate how this darkening of these surfaces will affect how quickly they may melt as well. So when we think about the response of these glaciers, they respond to temperature and precipitation, but they're also responding to the total amount of energy that they receive. And sunlight is one of those important sources of energy for melt during the summertime. So if we darken those surfaces, we can increase the intensity of the melt that a particular glacier sees. So not to be the bearer of bad news, but I suspect that with the new modeling, we may see even quicker melt for some of these glaciers when darkening is taken into account.
Trying to humanize some of the consequences of all this business, as I mentioned earlier, kids these days are not going to see many of these glaciers in the future throughout their lifetime. They will be the first generation to witness a lot of this melt. So, you know, people out there who are, you know, hearing this and feeling the doom and gloom more or less of the future with the issue of climate change continuing to show its face, you know, where do you find hope in doing this research? Obviously, it's quite intense and heavy, but where do you have hope for the future, knowing the reality of climate change?
I guess in some ways, I have a renewed sense of optimism. The work that myself and others do on glaciers, it is somewhat it's unfortunate and sad. You know, when you're actually doing the science, you hope to get that information to communities and to stakeholders so they can make the most sensible choices about water availability going forward. But it's still fascinating research, and it's a puzzle. It's tremendously interesting. But my renewed sense of optimism is, for example, thinking about how quickly the international community came together with the naked aggression that Russia showed towards the invasion of Ukraine. We now see that there are rapid readjustments of energy allocation, not necessarily away from fossil fuels. In some cases, that's the case. People have posited that there will be a rapid transition away from fossil fuel use. And it's not too it's not to call out and say that people, for example, working in the fossil fuel industry are bad people. Certainly, there are individual workers that are need to make a living, but we also need to ensure that we can, as a community, look towards opportunities to provide those workers with meaningful jobs going forward. And certainly, that is possible by turning away from fossil fuel and looking towards alternative energy sources. And fortunately, British Columbia is home to many of those energy sources.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Dr. Brian Menunez, thank you so much for your time and insight on this, and we will be sure to keep our eyes out for the next papers on your continued research on glacial melt here in Western Canada.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Pam Hassan, and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.